Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 116, recorded Wednesday, August 26, 2015. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: traveling through Japan and luggage trends. Coming to you today from the Travel Commons studios outside of Chicago, Illinois, after a long, long absence. Let's call it summer vacation, shall we? You know, and there was a nice bit of vacation there, 2 weeks in Japan with the family. People would ask me, have you ever been to Japan before? And I would always say, never outside of Narita, which I translated to the answer of mostly no before my trip, and updated to just a plain no after the trip. But more on that later. You know, over the years, I've gotten into the habit of leaving the country, leaving the U.S., if I want a real vacation. I find the disconnection process works much better if I'm more than, say, five time zones removed from home. You know, Europe is 6 to 7 hours ahead, pretty good, but the 14-hour difference between Chicago and Tokyo, now that's real separation. But you can't unplug for 2 weeks for free, though. I mean, it takes a bit of planning, and in my case, a good bit of travel, both before and after the trip. The 6 business days before my flight to Tokyo had me in Nashville, Detroit, Dallas, and then the day before I left for Tokyo, back out in Denver. I mean, I flew out Sunday night, flew home Monday night, and then left for Japan Tuesday at noon. Coming back, we hit O'Hare 3:30 Sunday afternoon, only to find myself back there in Denver 15 hours later on the first flight out Monday morning. I mean, I was just happy it was a short week for the 4th of July holiday. Now, since then, I've been sort of keeping up the Denver-Dallas triangulation with, I don't know, the random jump to somewhere like Detroit. I'll probably keep it up through August, since at the beginning of September, I'll be back out of the country again, this time to Edinburgh, helping my daughter settle in at University of St. Andrews. After all that, I just may sleep until October.
Today's podcast is brought to you by the Association of Airline Mile Programs. Researching, discovering, and inventing bold new ways to keep you from using your miles. The Association of Airline Mile Programs reminds you that flying blue miles transferred from American Express cannot be used without visiting your airport of departure and arrival with a birth certificate and the doctor who issued it. And even then, you're not using those miles, so why don't you just go play in traffic?
So following up, that was the start of a Stack Exchange podcast where Joel Spolsky pretty much goes sort of nonlinear over his attempt to use some frequent flyer miles. You know, any attempt to use frequent flyer miles will be a frustrating exercise. My recent attempts to do anything with the 300,000 BA Avios miles is my own personal exercise in masochism. I mean, it's insane. I'm not sure if there is a less valuable set of miles anywhere. But to be perfectly honest, I tell you, I've had pretty good luck this year getting, using frequent flyer miles. I got 2 flights down to New Orleans on Southwest, 4 direct flights, you know, kind of to and from Tokyo with United Airlines Mileage Plus, and now 3 flights between O'Hare and Edinburgh on American. Now, it wasn't a complete cakewalk. I mean, on Southwest, my wife and daughter had to take a 6 a.m. flight back on Monday. And on United, we had to come home a couple of days earlier than we had originally planned, while on the American flights over to Scotland in September, we come back a day later. But I'll tell you, flexibility, that's always been part of the price of using frequent flyer miles. And those minor shifts are a whole lot better than the exercise with BA. which only offered me one day in the entire month of September that I could use Avios Miles to get to Edinburgh. Like I said, I'm just not sure that there's a more useless awards program. Now, when I first started looking, though, for the Chicago to Edinburgh flights, I went straight to HipMonk. Now, HipMonk.com is my sort of my go-to flight search tool, and it's been that way for a while now. I mean, it's easy. It defaults to flight search, unlike Expedia's push for bundled deals or Orbitz's push for hotels. And the graphical display on HipMonk, kind of the bars for each flight showing flight duration spread throughout the day, make it really easy to focus on the flights that I'm most interested in. But when searching for Edinburgh flights, I spotted something new. Right under the red Virgin Atlantic bar was a purple one labeled Mystery. You know, kind of like Priceline's unnamed hotels that you bid for. But I'd never seen this on HipMonk, you know, what the travel industry likes to call opaque pricing. Of course, it wasn't really that opaque. I mean, clicking on the bar revealed the flight details, a 4:40 p.m. departure with an hour connection in Madrid. Yeah, let me think about that. Only Iberia flies from O'Hare to Madrid. And doing a quick search, I found that the times did indeed match Iberia's flight number 345, which HipMonk only slightly masked as Mystery Airline number 345. Must have been an experiment because I haven't seen it yet, but I did get a good chuckle out of it. A colleague who I met up with on one of my Detroit trips flew Spirit Airline for the first time and didn't get much of a chuckle. It was a last-minute meeting. He was flying in from Kansas City and following the rules by using our mandated American Express travel website to book his flight. And in doing that, he saw a Spirit flight that was significantly less than the other carriers. Now, being a good corporate citizen, he booked it. So he showed up at the ticket counter to get his boarding pass. Spirit agent pointed at his suitcase, said, "You going to carry that one on?" "Well, yeah," he said. Well, the agent said, "Well, that'll cost you $55. And, you know, that briefcase doesn't look like it's going to fit under the seat, so that's another $55. Pretty quickly, the price difference that led this guy to book Spirit sort of disappeared in that smoke of carry-on charges. You know, some might say it's his fault for not knowing Spirit's sort of uniquely aggressive add-on fee structure, what Spirit calls unbundling. But I'd say actually it's Amex's fault for displaying Spirit's base fare without any of the carry-on fees in the same way that that Amex displays, say, Delta or Southwest's fees. And then, marking those higher but more inclusive fares as being out of policy because they're higher and requiring additional steps to justify booking them. So, more power to Spirit to differentiate themselves with a unique fee structure, you know, but Amex and the like, Amex, Concor, all those guys, you know, they need to do their job and let business travelers know what they're in for when they book those low fares. You know, flipping to the Twitter feed, Rich Fraser saw my pre-check frustration spill over onto Twitter over kind of a couple of flights. I don't know if it's summer travel amateurs hitting the pre-check lottery, but I've just been stunned at the number of people who look amazed when the metal detector alarms when they try to walk through with a slug of metal in their pockets, mobile phones, big electronic key fobs, you know, a couple of fistfuls of change. I mean, what part of metal detector do they not get? I mean, it's doing its job. But people will stand there dumbfounded that they can't just sort of stroll through wearing, you know, sort of a quarter of a pound of metal and electronics that is, you know, the iPhone. I mean, I hate to be a snob, but I'm beginning to think that they need to split pre-check between the veterans who paid for it and the occasional random selectee lottery winners. Now, I said this, and, you know, Rich mentioned that it's not so occasional for him. He's gotten pre-check on three of his last four trips, so he says, hey, why pay for it? And, I mean, hey, as long as he remembers to take his mobile phone and keys out of his pocket, I say more power to him. You know, I've probably mentioned this before, but I think one of the absolute best airport restaurants is Rick Bayless's Torta Frontiera in the American, United, and International terminals at O'Hare. The tortas, the Mexican sandwiches, are fantastic. They're sort of great local ingredients, and they're made to order. Now, being made to order is key to the great taste and texture and, you know, crunch of the bread, but it's also 10 minutes from the time you order. And at O'Hare rush hour, you can stand in line for 10 minutes before you get to the counter to order. I mean, great restaurant and popular. So I was cautiously excited last week when I saw that they had a new ordering app. I was catching an evening flight to Detroit, and so I decided to check it out. I downloaded and set the app up after parking in the deck, you know, sort of created an account and loaded my Amex card. And then while in the pre-check line, I scrolled through the menu and loaded the shopping cart with a Cubana, my favorite torta. I was going to hit the order now button, but the TSA guy was, you know, they were a little too efficient, waving three of us up at once in the pre-check line. So I ended up hitting the order button a couple of minutes later when I was on the other side of the X-ray machine. Now, I quickly received an email, "Thanks for your order. We'll let you know when it's ready." And that was it. Sort of no ETA, no typical wait time. Yeah. So I walked down to the Terminal 3, the American. I was in American, so the Terminal 3 in O'Hare. So that tortoise. And it was the longest line I'd ever seen. So now I'm really beginning to wonder, and just then I get the second email, sort of 7 minutes after the first one. "Your order will be ready at 5:43 p.m., 10 minutes from now." So, okay, that's actually not bad given the line that I'm seeing there. So, and the fact that I don't have to stand in the line. So I walk to the restroom, I browse the bookstore across the hall, and put myself in front of the order pickup station at 5:43 p.m. And about a minute later, a woman, you know, kind of a woman behind the counter, calls out, "Hey, anybody order online?" And two of us, another guy and I, step up. "Mark?" And she says, I reach out, take my bag. The pre-order worked well, although next time I'll let the TSA guy wait for a minute while I hit the order button a little sooner. Now, all the way back in April of 2012, I wrote a blog post about free breakfast being the best hotel amenity. Now, I had to do a good bit of scrolling on the Travel Commons website to find it. I'll save that with a link in the show notes if you're interested in looking at it. Now, it's still true. I still think it's the best kind of best hotel amenity, even though it's, as I wrote back then, a bit more about convenience than food quality, especially when you're grabbing the breakfast in the concierge lounge of, say, a Marriott or a Sheraton or a Westin. And it kind of turns you into a connoisseur of scrambled eggs. Now, a buddy and I got into this conversation a few weeks back, comparing the quality of scrambled eggs across hotels we've stayed at. This, I have to tell you, is a pretty pathetic conversation. Well, we concluded that the most typical consistency was firm, sort of almost quiche-like. We like them with a bit of cheese mixed in to give them a bit of flavor. Neither of us are vegan. Every once in a great while, you get some great scrambled eggs, sort of soft curds, slightly moist. But you definitely don't want them runny. There's nothing more disgusting at 6 a.m. than tilting back that warming tray, you know, sort of clamshell lid, and seeing scrambled eggs sitting in a pool of sort of yellowish liquid. We'd go for the hard dry quiche over the swimming in yellow eggs every morning. But hard dry bacon, now that one, that's just wrong. And hey, if you've got any thoughts about what's right or wrong, questions, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send them along the email. As always, comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can use your smartphone to record and send in an audio comment. Send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, or you can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page. Or, as always, go old school. Look at the website. Oh, my God, why would you do that? Go to the website at travelcommons.com. Post your thoughts right there.
Looked inside me.
Thank you.
the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is traveling through Japan. Now, the family and I have done a fair bit of travel in Asia, Thailand, Singapore, Vietnam, Hong Kong, China, which left sort of two big holes in sort of that classic Asian itinerary, Japan and Korea. We filled one of them this summer when we spent 2 weeks visiting Tokyo, Kyoto, and Osaka. Now, Japan has always been on our list of places to visit, but its reputation for high prices kind of always gave us an excuse to put it off and go someplace where, you know, we could stretch our dollars further. But with the dollar buying 124 yen and then scoring four direct tickets, O'Hare to Narita, on United Mileage Plus Awards, well, it seemed like the stars had all aligned and this was the time. Now, as longtime listeners know, this won't be a travelogue, a list of things to do in Tokyo or Kyoto. I've got, you know, I sort of leave that to friends like Chris Christensen of the Amateur Traveler podcast. And since I've always said that this podcast is more about the journey than the destination, let's talk about travel in Japan. So as my family and I tend to do on our trips, our only trips to the airport were coming and going to the U.S. Everything else was on train, which in Japan works very well. My wife bought us these two-week Japan Rail or JR passes just before we left. Now, I'll tell you, it wasn't a small number for the four of us, but they paid off over our trip, allowing us unlimited use of the high-speed bullet trains, even to reserve seats for a bit more relaxed boarding. Now, we broke those passes in on the Narita Express, sort of the hour train ride from the airport to Tokyo Station. I'm not sure they could have put Narita any further out. I mean, given the distance, everybody takes the train or the bus. I mean, the train was fine, kind of like the Heathrow Express, but without the TV screens. I mean, and it worked with a minimum amount of fuss, which was a good thing, coming right on the back of a 12-hour flight from O'Hare. But we really hammered those JR passes to train among, you know, Tokyo, Kyoto, and Osaka. They were all less than three-hour trips. Some of the stations were huge, and there were times we had to sort of lean in to sort of thread through the crowds of commuters. But the signage was pretty good, and the trains absolutely met their reputation for timeliness. I mean, I'll tell you, if only airlines in the U.S. were half as timely. And while JR would roll a food cart while on the rails, we got a bit more into the Japanese train culture. We stocked up at the train station food courts before we left. Bento boxes, rice cakes, and of course, train beers. Kirin Tallboys, usually. And if we didn't have time to hit the food court, we could always grab something from the vending machines, which were positioned about every 20 feet on the train platform. The vending machine thing in Japan is intense and very, very convenient. Now, we didn't just train sort of point-to-point between the major stations. A lot of times it was a smaller train to the main station, then a high-speed train, then connecting to a smaller train to get to where we were staying. The Hyperdia smartphone app came highly recommended, and the free version was great while planning out these connecting journeys, both inner city and even within Tokyo, when a trip across town may span a couple of different rail companies, say Tokyo Metro to a JR train. It also displays the fare, which is very handy, avoiding the need to try and decipher the rate table while in front of the fare machine with a queue building right behind you. Now, I got to tell you, the public transit tab on Google Maps also worked surprisingly well. Being able to use these apps when you really need them requires mobile data for your phone. You don't want to be trying to search for an open Wi-Fi access point while trying to figure out which train you're connecting to. And so getting mobile data in Japan, like so many things, isn't exactly straightforward. As a tourist, you can only buy data SIMs, no voice capability. So one of my go-to websites, the aptly but awkwardly named Prepaid Data SIM Card Wiki, there is a link in the show notes. It came through again. I've mentioned this website on a number of other episodes. Before we left, I ordered a B-Mobile SIM to be delivered to our first hotel, the Marriott Courtyard in the Ginza District, and then bought another one, a Japan Travel SIM, from the Tourist Information Center at Tokyo Station. They both use the Docomo mobile network, which is the dominant mobile network in Japan, so we got great coverage. The lack of local voice wasn't a huge inconvenience for us. We were communicating via email with hotels and apartment rentals anyhow, but it still seemed a little weird. I have to tell you, though, the one thing that pulled me up short was the limited amount of signage in the Latin alphabet. Now, I'm okay with the Japanese names when they're phonetically rendered in Latin characters, but I'm not so hot on reading kanji or kana. I mean, we wrestled with this our first morning in Tokyo at the Tsujuki Fish Market. My wife had a list of sushi restaurant recommendations, all of which were Japanese names in Latin script. However, all the restaurant signs there were in kanji. And then at a Kyoto ramen restaurant where, you know, you buy your tickets for food from a machine and then, you know, hand those tickets across the counter to the cook, having only kanji on the machine buttons, like just kanji, no pictures, no nothing, made ordering a bit of a challenge and sometimes a crapshoot. I mean, it got me thinking back to my trip last year to Beijing. I didn't recall having the same challenge of signs only being in Chinese characters there. Now, what made all of this work is that just about all of the Japanese people we ran into were the nicest, most welcoming people, honestly, I've run into. I was constantly struck at how many people would strike up a conversation asking where we were from, helping us with the ramen machines, shouting, "Welcome to Japan," while riding past in a bike, you know, volunteering to walk us across train stations to help us with their connections. I'm not sure I've experienced that consistent level of engagement from random strangers anywhere else. Of course, it could get a little bit embarrassing, like the group of middle school kids who wanted a picture with me. I don't know why. Or my daughter, who would regularly get tagged by Japanese girls to, you know, have their pictures taken with her. We had had that experience a good bit in Beijing, but there, you know, we were often sort of the lone white people. It was understandable. You know, we stuck out. You know, having that same thing happen in Japan, more westernized, you know, there were just more Anglo people wandering around. That sort of surprised us. In Arishiyama, kind of a pretty, you know, a fairly touristy area on the west side of Kyoto, we were flagged down by three middle school teachers who videoed us answering their questions about why we chose to visit this town. They told us that they taught English and they wanted to show their classes native English speakers. I mean, all right, that makes sense. But, you know, you got to wonder, with all the videos on YouTube, I wasn't quite sure why they wanted a video of us. But that being said, I mean, except for the signage, Japan was one of the easier countries we've traveled in. And maybe, you know, I don't know, with a couple more revs of Google Translate, maybe even that barrier will get smoothed away. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is luggage trends. You know, I think it was when I was grabbing our luggage off the carousel in O'Hare returning from Spain this past spring with our luggage full of wine and olive oil, hence the reason for checking it. I picked up my wife's red bag and I was just struck at how tatty the fabric had become. I set it down in front of her and I said, "That is just embarrassing. I'm not sure I can travel with that bag again." Now, it's not that I have a styling bag. I mean, it's a stock Swiss Army black roller. I think it's still got the Vietnamese customs stickers from 2008. I had actually retired it in favor of a gray Samsonite bag, but I had to pull the Swiss Army bag back into service when the Samsonite's wheels got wonky. Kind of the rubber wore off and the wheels kind of splayed out after 2.5 years of pulling it across New Orleans sidewalks. So this got me, I don't know, between this, you know, between cycling through the Samsung bag and my wife's ratty, you know, ratty bag, I've just started looking at luggage. And, you know, one of the things I'm seeing is more hard shell rollers in non-black colors. Burgundy, yellow, floral prints, Disney characters. I mean, they look nice, but I don't know. Maybe that's just because they're different. They catch my eye because of what they're not. You know, a black ballistic nylon roller bag. And like I said, my recently deceased Samsung was non-black. I mean, it was gray rather than floral, but still non-black. But after 3 to 4 months of my travel schedule, it started to look less non-black. Smudges from grease on overhead bin hinges, muck from taxi trunks, muddy water from New Orleans gutters, spilled coffee. I mean, that's why I can't have nice luggage. You know, and as I start to look at some of these, some of these hard shell rollers, You can tell the ones that are being used by heavy travelers, they've got a lot of those same scuffs. And for some, the hard shell rollers, the hard shell cases show those scuffs a lot more. So I don't know how long that trend is going to last. Now, we've also talked about the impending trend of smart luggage in past episodes. Now, Blue Smart has been sort of the poster child for this. They just crushed their Indiegogo campaign last year. And 2 weeks ago, they announced that they're in volume production, targeting initial deliveries at the end of next month in late September. Control your luggage from the app is one of their taglines. Digital locks, digital scale, battery charger, location tracking, proximity alerts. I got to tell you, that list of functionality, it just spoke to my inner travel propeller head. So I did end up tipping over and doing the Indiegogo thing. And when that bag shows up, hopefully the end of September, I'll be sure to give you kind of that trip report on it. Now, Blue Smart is at the top of Google's searches for smart luggage, but there's a growing list of followers with kind of similar features. And location tracking is a big one. And it's interesting to me. I mean, I can count the number of times my luggage has been lost. I can count it on one hand and still have sort of change left over. But I got to tell you, when it happens, especially on a trip over to Europe or Asia, it can be catastrophic. I remember British Airways lost my bag on the way over, on the Atlantic crossing, on the way over to one of these sort of 2 week city a day trips that I would do, today, London, tomorrow, Stockholm, Friday, Zurich. And my bag was always just sort of one step behind me. And it didn't catch up to me until the weekend when I think I was in Paris for like 3 days straight. So I get the importance of location tracking. And at the high end, sort of Blue Smart and some others are equipping their bags with GPS and then cellular modems to enable global tracking. Now, at a much simpler level, travelers like, longtime Travel Commons listener Mika Prikala, I can never get Finnish names right. I mean, those folks like Mika are using Bluetooth key fobs like the Pally Smart Finder just to check and see if their bag has made it onto their plane. At least they can know whether they got a problem at the other end. I mean, I can see, I personally, as I've thought more about it, I mean, I can see, this sort of location sensing, proximity sensing and location tracking really being useful, not only at the boarding end, did my flight make it on, but also at the other end when I'm getting off the plane. I mean, it can take a long time for your bag to show up on the luggage carousel, say at O'Hare or at Detroit or San Francisco. This could be pretty useful. You get off the plane, you look at the app, hey, bag's not off the plane yet. I got some time. Got some time to stop off at the restroom, or maybe better yet, I got time for a beer. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 116. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. Check out the show notes for links, and links both to websites that I've mentioned, as well as the music links and notes for the interstitial music. Remember, you can find Travel Commons on iTunes, also on SoundCloud, also on Stitcher. So multiple places to find it and subscribe. If you've got a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along. Text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. And Peacock is the name on Twitter. There's the Travel Commons wall on Facebook. Or post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, and post comments on the website. And until the next time we talk, and hopefully it won't be, I won't have as long of a vacation. But until the next time, take care, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
Life is hell, strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing needs my mind, the warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when